Consumer Products versus Jensen. Mr. Perkins.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the Court, a couple of housekeeping matters. I've noticed in the review of our pleadings that we have discussed the unconscionable claim in one of the pleadings. That's because we dropped the ad of claim, and we neglected to provide a reference in our appellant brief as to Exhibit B, which is the requested jury instruction that was not given. Now, Your Honor, this was a very difficult case to try. We were hamstrung when we ended up having to go to trial in this matter. Mr. Jimmy Jensen has type 3 diabetes. It has killed his kidneys. He has to undergo dialysis 3 times a week. During a time that we were preparing for trial, he was suffering circulation problems resulting in an amputation part of his foot. He has problems, and any time he gets a sore or some kind of infection in extremity, it's very difficult to heal. We had told him we needed him at trial to testify. He had contacted his doctor, told him he intended to go. The doctor says, no, you're not going to go. He was concerned that he could not take the strain of flying back to Madison, Wisconsin to go to trial in this matter. So we were stuck in a situation where we had to proceed using only a deposition we had for Mr. Jimmy Jensen's testimony, which deposition was 1.5 to 2.5 months old by the time of trial. And because he was unable to be there, we had asked Judge Shabazz if he would allow Mr. Jensen to participate by video conferencing, where there was a camera and a screen in Spokane and a camera and screen before the court, so he could be heard and see and participate in the proceedings. The judge denied us that. We asked him to continue the trial so that we could try to get Mr. Jensen's health recovered to the point he could attend the trial. That motion was denied, and we had to go to trial without his presence in court, which was a real disadvantage.
Mr. Perkins, you didn't respond to the plaintiff's claim that you forfeited all of your challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence by failing to file post-trial motions.
And that's the Unitherm case, Your Honor.
Would you like to respond now?
Well, that's the Unitherm case, and we're very distressed by that case. That is rulemaking by judicial fiat. I come from the Tenth Circuit. The holding in Unitherm is not the rule at the Tenth Circuit during the time I was in practice there. And that was a case of being blindsided by not knowing of the requirement that if you make a Rule 50A motion, you then have to follow up within 10 days from the date of judgment with their 50B and 59 motion. We could have done that had we known. We didn't know it.
But, you see, the problem is there's nothing left for us review on this issue.
I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. I think that we filed a request for a jury instruction that we thought was vital. The plaintiffs drafted the agreement that they were suing under. The introductory paragraph of that agreement identified clearly two corporations. CPRD was a Wisconsin corporation. Intertech Corporation was a Washington corporation. Then they recited the lessee or the licensee was to be Tange, a Washington company. Now, they had had discussions with Mr. Jensen, who was the party who brought the expertise and the experience to the situation that they hoped to take advantage of.
How are you harmed by the court's failure to give your requested jury instruction?
Because the jury, we think it was important because the introductory paragraph recognized that there were two corporations and there was another entity of some type that was not identified. It wasn't a corporation. It wasn't a limited liability company. It wasn't a business trust. It wasn't a limited partnership. It wasn't a general partnership. It just wasn't referred to in any manner other that would have told the jury that the actual being and the actual factual case was that Tange was, in fact, Jimmy Jensen doing business as Tange. Mr. Kirchner had indicated that he did not want to license the product to Jimmy Jensen personally. He wanted to license it to a company. He didn't explain what his reasoning was. And they drafted the agreement. If it was to be construed, it should be construed against them, and they left this big hole that the jury should have been informed about. The jury should have been informed that a corporation is a separate legal entity. Tange was not identified and really was not.
Now, is it true that the defendants didn't pay a dime to...
That's correct.
Not a dime.
There was no the money exchanged. The only way any party was going to come out of this relationship was for the technology that Mr. Kirchner and CPRD had to be developed into a marketable product, the product to be sold, the sales collected, royalties paid, and that was what was going to pay everything. And in fact, there were verbal communications from Mr. Hinkes, who is a partner of Mr. Kirchner's, that he didn't view the contract ever to have gone into effect because nothing had been paid under it, and yet they sued to collect amounts due under the contract, and there was no evidence of any kind of economic harm to the plaintiff whatsoever. They didn't lose anything of value. They did not. They were not.
Well, they gave you a license.
Pardon?
They gave you a license.
That's right, a license to a product.
Their patent product. They gave you technical assistance.
It was a
They gave you working prototypes.
It was a non-exclusive agreement, and the prototypes were requested and paid for by the defendants, which prototypes were kept by the plaintiff, by the way, you know that they'd been paid for. So it was 2 years of effort on the parts
of... Well, I'm sorry. Are you saying that... Jensen paid for all of this?
Jensen paid for the prototypes that he got.
But you just said that they didn't pay a dime.
Well, they didn't pay any money under the payment provisions of the contract. So the contract, as drafted by the plaintiffs, provided for minimum quarterly fees and for upfront money. None of that was paid. And
so how much was paid? Let me try and figure this out.
Well, the only amounts paid were payment for the prototype units that we got from that the defendant got from Mr. Kirchner, and he paid about $5,000 for those, which units were kept by Mr. Kirchner, even though the defendant had paid for them. But a problem I have is that this is an action based on alleged fraud, and the fraud is alleged to have been ratified by Inatech Corporation. Ratification of a fraudulent act can be done, but there is the only contact or the only association that Inatech Corporation had with the deal was that it was named as a sublicensee, which was not bound by any term of the agreement and which was not granted any rights under the agreement unless a separate subsequent writing was entered into, which was never done. So it's very bothersome because as you look at typical cases brought claiming fraudulent inducement, there is usually a clear damage done to the party claimed to have been fraudulently induced. Kirchner paid no money. CPRD paid no money. They gave non-exclusive rights to license their product. They could have licensed it to other people. Mr. Kirchner tried for 3 years to get parties interested in this technology. Nobody ever took him up on it. He got back what he had with the property having the same value as it had when it was granted. There's just been no economic damage at all. Now, they're claiming that we were fraudulently induced to enter into this agreement. We would not have entered into this agreement had not fraudulent misrepresentations been made about the existence of Tange, and now we want all of the money that we're entitled to under this contract. That doesn't make sense to me. There's been no malice shown, no willfulness, no intentional misrepresentation, or no outrageous conduct that would support a finding of any kind of fraudulent intent. Mr. Jensen dealt with Mr. Kircher throughout the first part of the formation of this relationship and was told that he did not want to, the Kircher did not want to license it to Jimmy Jensen personally. He wanted a company and entity involved. So Jensen said, well, I've been looking at acquiring this Tange, except Tange was nothing more than an expired corporate registration in Washington, and he found that out after the deal was done with Kirchner. So it was really Jimmy Jensen, DBA Tange. The instruction we requested the court to give would have allowed the jury to look at the way that introductory paragraph was drafted and to discern that there were corporate entities clearly identified as such, and that Tange was not a corporate entity, and if it was not a corporate entity and not an entity that would have a legal existence of its own, there was no misrepresentation because the expertise and experience they were looking for was that of Jimmy Jensen. And they knew and admitted they knew that Tange was a new entity, that it had no track record, that it had no financials, and they are the ones that plugged in that recitation in the first part of the agreement that said that parties represent that Tange has experience and so forth, because Tange had nothing of its own. The only experience and track record and expertise was that of Jimmy Jensen.
Do you want to save some time, Mr. Perkins, for rebuttal?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
I do. Thank you.
Vote. May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Keith Vogt, on behalf of Pelley from the law firm of Stadheim & Greer. As Your Honors pointed out, with respect to there's five issues that we can discern that the appellants raise on appeal. Four of those concern sufficiency of the evidence claims, and one concerns the judge's decision.
Can you hear your voice up, please?
Sure. We have discerned five issues on this appeal, four of which concern sufficiency of the evidence claims, and one of which concerns the district court's decision not to use the party in interest jury instruction. As this court pointed out, the Supreme Court held in Unitherm that to preserve jurisdiction over sufficiency of the evidence claims, post-trial motions must be filed. They were not.
You know, you cited the Wisconsin standard for sufficiency of the evidence, but in diversity cases, we use the federal standard. Would your argument be any different under the federal standard?
I believe not, Your Honor. And that would be in light if this court decides to even a touch upon the sufficiency of the evidence claims. With respect to the jury instruction, Your Honor, that issue, I'm still not clear as to whether it relates to the liability case that was tried or the damage case that was tried. And when Your Honor asked how appellants were harmed, there really wasn't an answer, and it's still unclear here today as to why that instruction, not giving that instruction, had harmed them in any way. And with respect to the liability side, the courts are given wide discretion in deciding what jury instructions to give to the jury. And I believe the benchmark, the test, is that so long as the instruction accurately sets forth the law, the district court's discretion will be observed. And in this case, here on the liability side, there's several defects that the appellants have. First of all, they never objected to the district court's decision not to use the party in interest jury instruction. If you look at the appellant's brief on page 15, the only objection that they cite in the record to the jury instruction occurred during the damage trial. And by failing to object under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, they've waived that right to now have this issue decided on appeal.
Could we go through something that's
sure.
sort of bothering me? If we assume that the minimum royalties were due from the effective date of the license agreement, that's August 6, 2004, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Until the letter from the lawyer denying that any money is owed, that's May 1, 2006, right?
Correct.
So 1 year and 9 months have passed.
Approximately.
Okay. That's 7 quarters. And the minimum license fee would be $875,000, which is 7 times 125,000, right?
Yes.
Add that $35,000 initial fee, and the record would seem to support damages of $910,000.
Correct.
How did the jury come to $623,900?
I do not know, Your Honor. They were instructed just to provide compensation that they felt they would adequately compensate Mr. Kirshner for the benefits that he lost by the defendants not paying under the terms of the license. And besides that, Your Honor, that again would go to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, which there is no jurisdiction under Unitherm for this court to review.
Was there any evidence that would have told the jury of the value of the technical assistance and the prototypes that CPRD supplied to the defendants?
Your Honor, there was, as you might imagine, conflicting evidence presented. We had presented evidence in the record that the units were tested by the Janesville Fire Department and had generated much excitement there. And also there was evidence in the record as to the defendants or the appellants' own statements as to the value of the technology based upon the use of the prototypes at trade shows. And I believe that at the trade show, defendants had admitted that the our clients' technology had generated more interest than they ever had gotten at any single trade show. And then with respect on the other side of the coin, they did produce some evidence from an individual named Ping Chi who had some disparaging comments about the technology. Now, and continue on with respect to the jury instruction, if it was with respect to the damage trial is where the appellants raised their objection. And again, that goes to, I don't know how that jury instruction would have any relevance to that issue because the jury was just instructed to award compensation and to figure out a dollar amount or, and the alternative also to whether there was a decision or a determination to award punitive damages. Now, with respect to the actual sufficiency of the evidence claims, there was clearly evidence to support the jury's findings. I mean, for example, with respect to the argument that the defendant or the my client was defrauded of nothing. As Your Honor pointed out, there was the terms, the quarterly payments of the contract he was defrauded out of. He had provided them with technical assistance. He attended a trade show for them. There was certainly reliance and harm to my client with respect to their failure to pay. With respect to the no ratification by the Inatech Corporation, the law clearly holds that corporations act through their employees, and their president was present at the trial, and it was established at trial that he had signed the license agreement wherein whereas clause indicating that the corporate company TANS existed and had capabilities to commercialize this device. He signed that. The jury found that to be a false statement. He also signed an addendum, a confidentiality agreement, wherein, again, it was represented that TANS was a company that existed. The president of Inatech signed that. And they also had an addendum to protect their confidential information. And, again, president of Inatech, Ryan Jensen, signed that on behalf of Inatech Corporation. In addition, Your Honor, during several phone conversations, the evidence came out at trial that both Jimmy Jensen and Ryan Jensen were on the phone with our client representing the capabilities and the existence of the TANS company And then again is an act of ratification by Inatech's president, Ryan Jensen. With respect to the last, the punitive damages awarded in this manner, there was certainly evidence to support the jury's finding that it was reckless or with intentional disregard with respect to the rights of our client. We established that defendant Jimmy Jensen made intentional misrepresentations during phone conversations, signed documents containing misrepresentations, and also there was evidence that Mr. Jensen had previously been convicted of conspiracy to defraud. If you have any further questions, Your Honor, we have nothing further to say.
Apparently not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Perkins?
Well, this is the difficulty I was alluding to in telling you about the problems we had because Jimmy Jensen was not able to be there. He was not there. He couldn't hear the testimony as it came in. He couldn't give us guidance from that testimony and cross-examination. We had to talk to him in the evening and tell him what transpired and then find out what we should have done, in effect. So questions were asked on the next day's testimony that probably should have been asked the day before. As to no objection that the made to the judge not granting the right to use this instruction, I think a request for use of a jury instruction is similar to a motion to the court to require to use that instruction. The motion, in effect, was denied. I'm not aware you have to object to the denial of a motion to preserve anything about that issue as an issue on appeal. Now, the jury amount, I think, was clearly speculation. There's just no way to look through any of the evidence, any of the numbers in this, and come up with anything even close to what was awarded. They can't speculate. I think that what this really amounted to was that Mr. Kirchner, who was in love with his technology, thought it was of great value. He had not in 3 years been able to get anybody interested in trying to do anything with it. The initial indications that the defendants had in looking at the technology was that it had some value. They were both wrong. After 2 years of trying to do something with it, it was determined that they could not manufacture a unit of commercial viability with the technology that they had been given and the way it was documented. Thanks, the court.
Thanks, Person.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess for 5 minutes.